from the properly built studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another high-flying hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Many gardeners want to install bat houses on their property, but most of those houses will go unused. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal how to build a bat house that will be well occupied. Plus, a master's course on birds, and of course, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and demonically deficient denunciations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the sleek and savage studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another stripe-it hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we delve into both an article from the Associated Press and my fond childhood memories, which we're calling Tigers, Tigers, Burning Brightly. The newspaper headline, Protective Efforts Help India's Tiger Population Grow. The story is based on a study recently published in the journal Nature. And I quote, India has doubled its tiger population in a little over a decade. The numbers grew from an estimated 1,700 tigers in 2010 to around 3,700 in 2022, according to the National Tiger Conservation Authority, making India home to roughly 75% of the global tiger population. Continuing, quote, some communities have benefited from this increase because of the revenues brought in by ecotourism. This success shows that conservation efforts can benefit both biodiversity and nearby communities. End quote. But this study focused only on Bengal tigers. There are 9 tiger species alive today, with Bengals being the most numerous. Population numbers vary quite a bit depending on the source, but the total number of tigers in the wild is between 4,000 and 5,500. Unfortunately, my favorite, the Siberian tiger, found mostly in eastern Russia, appears to be down to a scary 400, although at least hundreds more exist in zoos and professionally managed reserves, which is really important as the wild groups now lack the genetic diversity for sustained healthy breeding. One of my most cherished childhood memories is visiting the Philadelphia Zoo with my dad and my grandfather, Foxy. I would spend most of the day watching the polar bears, whose outdoor lake was filled with huge ice blocks for play and for cooling, and the otters, whose aquatic habitat included a water slide on which they always seemed to be playing. Most of the zoo's habitats were ahead of their time for the 1950s and early 60s. But the few exceptions still make me sad. And remember, outside of a zoo, the only other place you could see elephants, tigers, lions, and the like was at a traveling circus, where even at a young age, I worried about the animals' care and well-being. But I would immediately leave those other habitats at the zoo when I heard the call of the wild, the big cat signaling that feeding time was approaching. The outdoor Siberian tiger habitat was especially well constructed for its time, with a large moat in between visitors and the big cats, who, when they were not swimming, lounged in the sun on an island where they could roll over and play, much like house cats. Behind that was an enclosed tunnel to the lion and tiger house, where each species would saunter out to large individual cages, roaring, purring, and rubbing their massive bodies against the rails. It was the closest we visitors could get to the big cats, and I dare say we all came away with awe and great respect for their size and almost impossible beauty. And those encounters are why I now donate to a number of wildlife conservation organizations in the hope that we will always have tigers. Note, International Tiger Day is July 29th. Do not hug a tiger in celebration. Instead, donate to an organization devoted to preserving their existence in the wild.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up shortly, it is a lovely idea to build a bat house in your backyard so that these creatures can eat your mosquitoes for you. Two problems. Bats don't eat a lot of mosquitoes, and most houses are not built properly and wind up being unoccupied. In the question of the week, we will tell you how to make a proper bat house and the advantages that brings to your property. But first, another of your fabulous phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for answering my call.
Well, thank you for being on the line with us today. How is Lisa?
I'm doing well.
And where is Lisa doing well?
In the Lehigh Valley. Right now I'm in Bethlehem.
Okay, well, so am I. And what can we do you for then?
I've got a question. One of my buddies has a house that the vines have overtaken it, and this has gone on for a few years. It's overtaken the entire side of the house. I mean, it is beautiful and lush looking, but I'm very sure that it's not good for the foundation or any of the parts of the house. And we've talked about how would we want to go about getting them taken down. So I'm trying to see what is the smartest way to do it and how to do it without having to use toxic chemicals.
Well, in this case, you sent a very telling photo of a house whose side wall is completely covered. And in fact, one of the upper story windows is covered. So it does not anybody live up there? They like having the vines on the outside?
I think it's a matter of just having a busy few years and just had other things that took priority over with the time and the budgeting and stuff like that. I think it just was a matter of they didn't keep it up, or they just couldn't address it when it started, and then it got so bad.
Right.
It was overwhelming and they were taking care of other things.
You know, it's a lot like they used to say about losing weight. It's going to take you just as long to lose it as it did to put it on. And hopefully that won't be the case here, although you do have an enormous amount of plant matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's some form of ivy. People always call it English ivy, but the American Ivy Society has challenged me on this and said the English ivy isn't as invasive. They say it's Irish ivy. Like we need.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, like yeah, like we need more people to pile on. But no matter what kind of an ivy is, it has a very waxy surface. So
yeah.
If you feel it, you can tell nothing you spray on it is going to stick.
Yeah.
So the first thing you want to approach is physical removal. And you begin that by simply severing everything you can at the soil line. I wouldn't be surprised if some of those roots are fairly large down where the vine meets the ground.
Yeah.
So they need to be severed at the soil line. And then I think it was a brick exterior.
Yes.
Well, you're going to have to have an expert come out and take a look at it. Because what happens with ivy in this situation is it can get into the mortar. What happens with ivy in this situation is the little tendrils get into the mortar. That's how they climb up. And you can't do anything foolish, or you could damage not so much the foundation even, but the actual side of the house. The first thing you want to do is have it all severed at the ground. And then over the course of this spring and summer, it will brown and die. It's not taking any nutrients from the bricks or anything else. It's only taking nutrients from the ground. And then when it's all dried up, you know, I'm thinking that this could be maybe 700-800 pounds worth of plant material. So you probably want to have a professional remove it from the side of the building. No matter what else you do, you know, it has to come off. And that's going to involve close inspection of the mortar and the bricks. And then depending on what you find out there, it might be as simple as hiring somebody to come in, not with a cherry picker, but with one of those things like they have at Home Depot, where it's like 6-7 feet tall and you can make it go up to like 20 feet. And starting at the top, literally pull it off. And then you're going to have to be careful how you get rid of it. I don't think the township is going to accept it because of fear it'll spread. But once it sits out for a full summer in the heat on concrete, it should become really most sincerely dead. So then you'll need to examine any damage to the exterior, and that is the time to get the bricks repointed. And obviously you have to be especially careful around those windows, because I presume it has attached itself to the actual glass from what I could see. So you really want somebody who can get up high and work it from the top. But none of this is going to happen till like July or August. The first part is cutting it off at the ground level.
Okay.
And then after you get the ivy off, and I know that house, by the way, I used to work real close to there when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that house gets full sun on that side. So once you get this big mass off, a professional landscaper can dispose of it for you. Then you really got to look at what's left behind. the normal conventional advice is then take a chainsaw and make a lot of different cuts in the top of the vines if they're more than like the thickness of your leg. And then the conventional wisdom is to paint them with Roundup. But the real secret is if you just crosshatch them, the wood will rot away. And when it does, and of course you want to be progressively cutting it off down lower and lower until there isn't anything left behind, crosshatch it heavily. And then I hate to even say this, but this is a good use for wood chips. Smother the area with like 6 inches of wood chips, preferably not the dyed chemical stuff that you get in bags, but arborist wood chips. And arborist wood chips are just wood cut from a fresh tree. And then smother it. Now, you may see, did you ever see Guardians of the Galaxy with Baby Groot coming back to life?
Yeah.
You may see Baby Groot trying to come back up. But now it's a piece of cake. You just keep an eye on it for a year, cut it off with pruners, and then spray that area with either regular white vinegar or horticultural vinegar, which is stronger. And that will slowly kill the vine underground without you introducing any chemicals to the equation.
Okay. So when you're saying to get someone to remove that off of the wall, like after you've cut it and it's died and stuff like that, are you talking about like a landscaper? That's the kind of professional I would be calling?
Well, you kind of got two things going here. You definitely need a landscaper to haul away the bulk material and help get it off. But you're probably going to need a brick and mortar guy to examine the bricks and repoint them. But it all begins with you cutting it off at the soil line as soon as possible and letting it all brown out. It's a physical job, not a chemical one.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
If you'll be patient, it will work really well.
Okay. I have faith. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck to you and them.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone out there who aims to start their own plants from seed for the first time that you're probably going to make a mess of it. But all those first-year failures will lead to future success. But don't go searching our previous articles on successful seed starting just yet, because we'll be right back to interview an ornithologist and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, last week, we told you why not to use bug zappers. This week, we're going to talk about bat houses, which you should use. Just be warned that unless you pay close attention and you're really good at it, they may not hold many bats. But right now, it's time to welcome our special guest, Stephen Kress, a visiting fellow of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and founder of Audubon's Project Puffin. He has a lifelong interest in creating habitats for birds and a focus on native plants that benefit both birds and pollinators. He received his undergraduate and master's degrees in wildlife management from Ohio State University and his PhD in environmental education from Cornell. Among his many books on birding and backyard wildlife management, he is the author of The Bird Garden. Stephen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
We are happy to have you here. We originally wanted to have Steve to promote a native plant gardening for birds lecture he gave for the Cornell Cooperative Extension. But time and life got in our way, and we missed that. But then we found out Steve is going to have a course, 8-week course on exploring birds and their lives that starts March 24th and runs through May 19th. You can attend in person at Ithaca or via Zoom. Tell us what you have planned for your seminar attendance.
All right. So this course called Spring Ornithology is really become quite a tradition here in upstate New York. Taught live at the Kendall residence here in Ithaca, but I also offer it on Zoom so people anywhere in eastern U.S. can attend, and many do throughout the eastern states. It focuses on how to identify the common spring birds, and in these 8 weeks, I start each of the sessions out with a group of birds that is migrating through eastern states on their way to their breeding grounds. For example, the first week, we talk about resident birds and early migrants, like the blackbird clan that shows up in late March when we're starting. And then we move on to waterfowl, which are also migrating through in the spring. And then later we move on to raptors, hawks and owls, and then the long-distance migrants, the neotropical migrants, that are like the tanagers and the grosbeaks and the buntings, all those beautiful, colorful birds that breed here during the summer. So each week, and plus that, I also talk about topics in ornithology, which is important to think not just about identifying birds, but about their family life, their songs, and the migration mysteries that continue around birds. An important part of this course also is about how to improve your property for birds, because as stewards of this planet, we have a job to do, and that's to take care of the birds. And the best thing that people can do is to look after their own properties or nearby parklands. So I talk about tips on how to use native plants and how to make our properties more bird-friendly. It's something I do on my own land here, and I've been doing it for decades now.
So I'll guess that the number one rule of attracting birds to your property is don't use any kind of pesticides.
Well, that's certainly right up in the top of the list, yeah. And there's many other rules we can talk about. But sure, a good place to start is not to use poisonous chemicals. They not only affect the birds directly, but they affect the whole food chain. Spray them on the ground, they don't stay on the ground. They move through the water. and they move into the insects, and then they move into the birds' diet. So if you care about birds, stay away from those chemicals.
Right. If a spray hits a bug and a bird eats that bug, the bird just got a concentrated dose of death.
Exactly. Yeah. Birds eat thousands of insects to raise their young, and concentrating all those insects, if they are polluted, then the birds have a problem, the chicks especially.
Yeah, we had that famous example of the American bald eagle that so symbolic it got DDT pulled off the market. Now, what are some of the things that people can do around their home? Now, you may disagree with me, or you may not, but I urge people not to put out artificial seed feeders because it disrupts the baby birds learning how to find their own food. And a lot of disease gets spread at these bird feeders. In my humble, oh so humble, opinion, they're there for human amusement only, and they could harm the birds.
Yeah, so what's generally called supplemental feeding has a lot of caveats around it. The notion that birds have some sort of or have become dependent on people to feed them is really not true. It's a myth. So you're right. The benefits are for people, not for birds. And if there is a season when birds do need our help, but providing food, it would be in the winter after very heavy snowfalls when the ground is covered or there's ice on branches hiding food. But remember this, that and I hope your listeners probably know this already, that not very many species actually even come to feeders. It's a very short list. On our property here in upstate New York, we can see like over 100 species of birds, and counting the migrants that come through. And, you know, very few of those actually even come to feeders. So it benefits few birds, relatively few species, and only during a short periods in the winter. And bird feeding brings with it many risks: collision with windows, vulnerability to outdoor cats, exposure to possible diseases. So if people want to help birds and they want to provide benefits for birds, I would put bird feeding low on the list. But the most important thing is to create habitat for birds. Sterile yards where the lawn is trimmed frequently and where there's been a manic gardener that has raked and pruned everything down to the ground, that is really the worst thing you can do for birds.
Right, because you're destroying what would be their natural habitat.
Exactly, and a habitat for the insects that they eat. So I encourage people to think about creating habitat. Sometimes the best thing they can do is less. Think about this. A tidy gardener is not a good bird gardener. But letting corners and places, especially around the edges of your property, just grow up, that's a good thing. And most gardeners are happy to know that doing less is really doing the best thing possible for birds.
I want to go back to what you said about winter. You're right in line with my recommendations. I say in winter, especially a harsh one, it's perfectly appropriate to put out suet feeders because they provide the high levels of fat and protein that the birds really need. You know, some seeds are just junk food.
Right. Not all birds eat seeds. Some birds greatly prefer suet. Woodpeckers, nuthatches.
Chickadees.
Chickadees also love suet. Titmice, you know. These are birds that feed on wintering insects that are hidden in the barks and crevices of trees are high in fat and high in protein. And so eating these are their preferred natural foods. So when we put out a block of suet, we're providing basically like a bonanza of winter grubs and larvae that these birds would normally eat. So, yeah, we're really helping those birds, birds like juncos and winter sparrows, like the tree sparrows. They're more seed eaters. Cardinals don't really care much about suet. Some seed eaters would benefit from seeds. But your point also about junk seeds is well taken. Let's talk about that. If you go out and to buy food and you buy the lowest priced bag of bird seed, you're actually buying a lot of seeds that birds don't really like that much. For example, millet, red millet, and milo. Those two reddish-colored seeds are produced for agriculture and often for food for cattle. And when there's leftovers in the marketplace, they sometimes end up in bird food. So if you're going to feed seeds at all, there are a few that have proven themselves time and again as bird favorites. Black oil, sunflower seed.
Number one, right?
By far number one. But here's something to think about. A cheap variety of black oil sunflower seed is not as good as a high-priced quality generally. And if you take a look at those sometimes grocery store low-cost sunflower seeds, you'll find little holes in the seeds. There are tiny little beetles that will get into seeds, and some of these are not as good as others. And you know what? The birds can tell. I've seen at my own theater slow-motion photographs of birds eating sunflower seeds. They pick up seeds, they squeeze them, they hold them, they assess the weight of the food and the hardness of the food to determine if there's a weevil inside of it. That's a larva of a little sunflower specialist beetle that destroys a lot of sunflower. And they will drop the ones that are lightweight, picking through to find the best quality food. Well, you can avoid all that by buying higher quality food or looking at the seed to see if it's actually got little holes in it. It's amazing.
We could almost buy by weight of the same size bag?
I wonder. I don't know for sure. No, we can look at it. You can see these holes. It's really a revelation to look at the seed. Just watch the birds at your feeder, and you can see what they're doing. They'll tell you whether the seed's any good.
Right. The seeds that haven't been eaten after five visits were probably not a good idea.
Right.
One thing I want to toss in here, because it's something I stress every year, is that the birds don't need your seeds. But in summertime, they certainly could use your water. So bird baths, especially circulating ones, and the larger the better, they're going to promote the health of the birds much better than any kind of seed in summer, right?
Yes, birds do need water in the summer, especially in our increasingly hot summers. Not all bird baths are created equal if we're talking about bird baths here for drinking. A bird bath that is more of a deep bowl, the birds might drink out of it, but they won't bathe in it. And they do like to cool down and bathe in bird baths as well. So a shallow bird bath is good. It's important to change the water in bird baths frequently. You can do this just by spraying from a hose fresh water into it. And the reason why that's important is that it gets dirty. Algae can start growing in it. And even worse, mosquitoes can start breeding in it. Now, your idea of moving water is important. Moving water, especially a little just drip in the water, that attracts birds. People that have some sort of a drip attachment to the water supply keeps the water fresh, keeps it moving. They'll see more birds coming. And equally important, the mosquitoes do not like to lay eggs in moving water. That interferes with the little breathing apparatuses of the maggot, of the larva, and they know better than to lay their eggs in moving water. They won't breed as successfully. So you can clean that water, and mosquitoes develop very rapidly. They carry diseases for birds and for people, so it's important to keep an eye on that. You'll see those little maggots in there. In 3 days, they can transfer from an egg to an adult.
One of our most popular topics is mosquito prevention. And I really hammer people. You know, the old advice used to be to empty all the standing water on your property. Well, I say leave the standing water, put out more buckets, and treat them all with BTI dunks or granules, which are totally non-toxic, but as you know, prevent the development of that larva into biting adults.
That's right. That is an option. But here's another option to consider. And I've done this on many of my little pools and ponds, which I, on our property, we have at least 8 little pools and ponds. I try to keep big predatory fish out of these ponds because they eat the foods that the birds like to eat.
Right. Like, once again, you're talking about for human amusement.
Well, I'm talking about mosquitoes here because if you have insects like dragonflies and damselflies and water striders and boatmen, back swimmers, these are all insect-eating predators, and they will come naturally to any little pond. And so if you dig a little lily pond to attract birds and also to attract insects, they will take care of the mosquitoes. I've got one of these right outside my house, which is totally mosquito-free. It's full of frogs and newts and salamanders and dragonflies. It's a mecca for life. And birds come to that as well. So, yeah, the dunks are great in certain situations, but the free insects that are out there are also terrific mosquito predators.
That's a good point. Now, one last thing on this topic. What do you think about heated water sources in the winter?
I think heated water sources can be attractive to birds. The problem with them often is that the heating evaporates the water, and you have to really stay on top of that just to make sure you actually have water.
Now, your classes for the Cayuga Bird Club's Spring Ornithology with you, they're going to start March 24th through May 19th. People can find more information and obviously hear a lot more about native plants and the relationship to birds and which plants are attractive to birds. So if people want to learn more about this course, what it costs, I should mention that if you can't be online at the prescribed time, that you can watch it later. Should they go to cayugabirdclub.org?
Yes, if they do, they will see a link right to the registration, and they could sign up today. We're still taking registrations. The course is filling up, as it always does. Be happy to have your listeners as part of the class.
Boy, that feels great, doesn't it? When all of a sudden people crowd into the room for you.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, this has been such a long, cold winter, and the snow is piled up. We have a lot of people that are really eager to learn about birds. Birds brighten our days with their song and with their colors. And there's so much amazing details about them that just leave us in awe. So I really enjoy telling people to listen up, listen to the birds, watch, and it just brings everyone a lot of joy.
It brings everybody joy. Just the other day, I was in my office, which was designed to have nothing but windows looking out into the woods behind my house. And I saw a cardinal fly in, you know, with everything else colored white. I almost fell back in my chair.
Mm-hmm. And they're starting to sing as the days get longer, on warmer days. Listen, you'll hear them. You'll hear the chickadees and the titmice also tuning up. And the first woodpeckers will be drumming any day.
I have lots of woodpeckers. I always leave dead trees standing on my property. You know, we call them snags. Because they're essentially bird hotels, bird restaurants. They're everything wildlife needs, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I think you taught our listeners quite a bit. It's been a pleasure having you. We've been talking with Steve Kress, who will teach hold the Cayuga Bird Club's spring ornithology class, which live or Tuesday evenings, March 24th through May 19th. But you don't have to attend any of the classes in person. You can catch up later at your leisure or your leisure. Just from what we've talked about today, I can tell you you're going to learn a lot. For more information, visit CayugaBirdClub.org. Steve, thank you very much, man. It's been a blast.
It's been a real pleasure, Mike. Let's do it again sometime.
All right, sir. Bye for now. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that homegrown starts require a light, loose, professional seed starting mix, tall, deep containers, and lots of lumens. And yes, you do need artificial light. So do your plants. But don't go making that list and checking it twice just yet, because we'll be right back with tips on how to make a bodacious bat house and more of your bodacious phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Do little wristbands really protect you against mosquitoes? What about the famed mosquito-repelling plant? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what really does deter those little bloodsuckers. Plus your fabulous phone calls and who knows what else. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to an especially thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the thrilling studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. Coming up shortly, it is a lovely idea to build a bat house in your backyard so that these creatures can eat your mosquitoes for you. We will tell you how to make a proper bat house. But first, another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Irene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, is this Mike?
Yes, it is. Is this Irene?
Yeah, this is Irene in Allentown. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. I'm just Ducky. And what can we do for you in Allentown?
Well, I have a couple persimmon trees that I tried to plant last year. They were all like a miserable sick, some foot long and some little over a foot. And with the winter I had, I hope they survive. Do I need to cover it in the future?
No. No, persimmons are a Native American fruit.
Really?
Yes. There's only two Native American fruits, unless you count blueberries, and that's pawpaws and persimmons. So they're used to it, and they may not look their best right now. In my opinion, persimmon trees never really look that great, but I assume you have a taste for persimmons.
Oh, yeah, we love them.
Okay, very good. And when you were talking to my producer, James, you said you wanted to ask about something else?
Yeah. Is the time to plant spinach and my peas out now?
Well, yes and no. This is the kind of weather they like growing in, but depending on the nighttime temperatures, it could be too cold to sprout the seeds.
I see. What if I have them sprouted?
Do you?
Yes.
Okay, what do you have sprouted?
Spinach.
Okay, tell me what kind of a container, what did you sprout it in?
I sprout them in just like potting mix with peat moss, and I put them in those, breaking down those peat moss cups.
Okay. You have to be careful with those because they dry out very quickly. But how tall is your spinach?
2-3 inches.
Okay. And what do you intend to grow the spinach in outside?
In a pot, in a big pot.
Okay, and that's filled with potting soil?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I think you're ready to rock and roll with your spinach. You can take it outside. I would plant those containers first thing in the morning, so that the plants have a little bit of time to get acclimated before the temperature drops. Once they get outside and once they get past a couple of days, they'll be fine. And spinach started already, grown in this month, is going to be very sweet. You're doing...
Why is that?
Because of the cold weather. Spinach and lettuce can't survive in the summer. They can't take the heat. But when grown in the spring, and especially in the fall, you can do this again in the fall, and you don't have to start the seeds inside because the soil's going to be warm. Then you'll get the sweetest tasting salad greens. Now, what kind of peas are you going to grow?
I have a mixture. They have what they call, one is called early frost, one is called Lincoln, and the other one is telephone pool.
Oh, are you sure they're all peas and not beans?
Uh-huh. They are all round. They're not oval.
Oh, okay. So what's the name of the first one again?
Early frost.
Okay. Do you have the seed packet? Does it say whether it's a snow pea or a snap pea?
I think they are not snap peas. They're just regular, those round peas for eating. Okay. They're not sugar peas.
And does it say bush or pole?
I think they are pole.
Okay. Well, have you grown them before?
I do. And they kind of miserable. They either die inside or get eaten outside.
Well, pole beans and peas need a tall trellis, taller than we are. Generally, people like to grow it up against like a 7-foot fence or something like that. But they need a very tall trellis to climb and cling to. And they would be a favorite of deer. But what you would do, and as long as they're peas and not beans, take each variety, moisten some paper towels, roll the pea seeds into the moist paper towels, put it in a Ziploc, but don't zip it shut. And do a separate Ziploc for each of your varieties and label it with a marker. And when you see the little wiggly sprouts come out of the seeds, you can then plant them outdoors. But again, they're going to need something sturdy to climb on.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too. As promised, it is time for the question of the week. Do bat houses really house bats? As you may or may not recall, last week's feature explained in depth how bug zappers don't zap many, if any, mosquitoes. But they do kill a lot of beneficial insects and spray you with electrified bug guts. This explanation was prompted by my discovery of a post at a website called Kindness for All Living Beings, urging people not to use the useless machines. However, later posts and comments did urge people to put up bat houses and included the claim that one bat can eat between 1 and 25,000 mosquitoes a night, and then went on to explain how to build and position a bat house that will actually house bats. As the Beach Boys famously sang, wouldn't it be nice? The Benton County Mosquito Control District of Washington State is one of many reliable sources that explain how this idea got into people's heads. And we quote, in 1960, D.R. Griffin, F.A. Webster, and C.R. Michael published a study called The Echolocation of Flying Insects by Bats in the journal Animal Behavior. The purpose of their study was to test and observe the echolocation of bats, not their feeding habits. So what better prey than something small like mosquitoes to really test the bat's ability to find prey? Only proven hunters were used. That is, the scientists made sure to use bats that had been observed to be active and aggressive hunters. The testing room was 8 feet by 16 feet. Hunting sessions were 10 to 15 minutes in length. 2,000 mosquitoes, and only mosquitoes, were released into the testing room. One bat did achieve capturing 9.5 mosquitoes per minute on average. But this same bat, on another testing round, captured only 1.7 mosquitoes per minute. The scientists also recorded that on other occasions, the same bats gained very little weight or even lost weight while flying in the chamber. At one time, a bat did achieve the 9.5 mosquitoes per minute capture rate, was what was later used to come up with the claim that bats eat 600 mosquitoes per hour. The researchers' conclusions. The Benton County researchers conclude, quote, we agree with the assertion that bats will feed upon mosquitoes, but based upon numerous other studies, we believe it has been shown that bats are opportunistic feeders and are not an effective or reliable form of mosquito control. Our concern is the misinformation that comes from taking one sentence out of an entire study and then making wide-sweeping assumptions that may affect the public's perception about effective mosquito control habits. Now, another popular myth is that purple martins eat extremely large numbers of mosquitoes daily. However, the Purple Martin Conservation Society addresses this issue at their website, where it states purple martins do not eat a large number of mosquitoes. Martins feed high in the sky during the daytime, so they do not come into contact with mosquitoes very often. Nighthawks might be the best mosquito-eating birds, as they do fly by night. That said, it can be fun and entertaining to have a proper bat house on your property. Bats do eat lots of insects at night, many of which are the moth form of caterpillar pests. But making a bat box that will be occupied by actual bats can be a considerable task. The following details are compiled from a fabulous website called Bat Conservation International. The boxes need to be open at the bottom and provide at least a 10 to 20 foot drop without obstructions for the bats to exit in their natural manner. The boxes have to be positioned in a way that works with your climate. Bat houses in hot regions should not be facing the sun, while houses in cooler climates should be facing the sun to warm up the bats inside. In addition, hot climb houses should be painted white on the outside to reflect the heat. Never paint the inside of a bat box. Size really matters. Sources generally suggest that each box be able to contain a minimum of at least 25 bats, as they are highly social creatures that use their numbers to cool the house on a hot day by spreading out and keep it warm during colder times by huddling together. Bigger bat houses are more likely to be occupied than smaller bat houses. Bat Conservation International also recommends a kind of bat twin, with one box painted to absorb the sun, another painted to repel it, and a connecting space at the top to let the bats move freely back and forth. That's a really cool idea. No matter what kind of house, don't disturb them by trying to peek inside. If the house is occupied, there should be distinctive piles of bat guano underneath. It's fine to harvest this nitrogen-rich material for your garden, but be sure to wear a high-quality dust mask, wear good gloves, and mix the material into the center of a compost pile. And finally, don't use any kind of treated wood. The preferred wood is rough pine, especially rough on the inside, to help them cling. And of course, you must have a pesticide-free garden, but you already knew that. Join us again next week for the final installment in this series, the one you've been waiting for, the things that really do work to keep you bite-free. Well, that sure was a lot of good bat advice, now wasn't it, fearless followers? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes! My producer is threatening to boycott my bats if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And as always, if you happen to live anywhere, please tell us where it is. And visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and invite you to send us photos of your precious plants, share your thoughts about the show, receive important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when Igor picked a wrong brain for his crazed mad doctor fiend. Friend. Our musical director is Ken Quita.
Quita, I like that. Quita, get over here.
Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Zipro. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to our guest, Steve Kress. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And I'm dodging colds, the flu, black ice, COVID, not to mention snowstorms, ice storms, and Sue storms. But I planned ahead and cornered the market on calcium chloride and started using a flat garden shovel instead of my regular snow shovel, because that ain't snow out there, cats and kittens. It's an iceberg. So God willing and the crick don't rise, I'll get through that bird and see you again next week.